supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Friends and colleagues are remembering former New Jersey Governor Brendan Byrne. He died yesterday at the age of 93. The Democrat served two terms in the 1970s and 80s. He was famous for enacting a state income tax, and he talked about that in this campaign ad from 1977.
4 years ago, I promised to give you the property tax relief you asked for, and that was right. I also thought we wouldn't need the income tax, and that was wrong. The income tax was a tough decision for me to make, and a lot of people didn't like it. But because of it, most of you are getting the property tax relief you asked for. With homestead rebates, school tax refunds, lower property tax rates, and additional help for older citizens. Sometimes you have to admit you are wrong in order to do what's right. That's what a governor has to do.
Byrne had a long friendship and political working relationship with his successor, Republican Governor Tom Kaine. Kaine says Byrne gave him invaluable advice.
When I was governor, he and I would sit quietly after a tennis game, and he would advise me as to what he thought I should be doing with the then Democratic legislature, which he knew a lot better than I did. And and we had a lot of those quiet talks that nobody else knew about, but influenced me profoundly as to how I dealt, how I tried to get policy through, and how I was able to work for 8 years with the Democratic legislature.
Kaine says even without Byrne, the income tax would have become law in New Jersey. But he says two other key accomplishments would not have happened without him, including safeguarding the Pinelands in New Jersey.
It was a very, very important measure for the state. It's the largest open space now between Boston and Atlanta, in the most crowded state in the country. It was a tremendous accomplishment, and one that he'll obviously go down in history for. And the other was casino gambling. He was the only governor for about 30 years who would have signed a bill promoting gambling. All the rest of us were against it. So we wouldn't have had gambling in New Jersey if it hadn't been for Brendan Byrne.
Brendan Byrne was also noted for his sense of humor.
Remember the poll that showed that 96% of the people in New Jersey knew who I was, and 4% thought I was doing a good job.
Governor Kaine says Byrne was funny enough that politicians stole his jokes.
The one that he was maddest about, that he really did come up with, was the fact that now he'd left the governorship, people were waving at him with all five fingers. And a lot of people, including Bill Clinton, stole that and never gave him credit. And Brendan was furious at that. He said, "That's my joke, I came up with it, and they used it, and at least they could have the decency to give me credit."
Tom Kaine, remembering his friend and fellow former governor Brendan Byrne. A memorial service will be held Monday at the Paper Mill Playhouse in Millburn, and Governor Chris Christie is scheduled to deliver the eulogy. Philadelphia officials are advocating that the city become the first in the nation to open a supervised injection site. That's where those suffering from heroin or opioid addiction would inject the drugs under medical supervision. I'm joined by WHYY's Bobby Allen. And Bobby, first off, what exactly is a safe injection site?
So a supervised injection site, also called a safe injection site, it's interchangeable, is a place where people who want to use drugs walk into a facility and they bring their own drugs. And the drugs can then be tested for fentanyl, which is this really, really, really strong synthetic drug that is 50 to 100 times as powerful as heroin. So it can be tested for fentanyl, and they could decide whether they still want to use it. If they do, then medical staff will come and provide clean equipment. And this isn't just clean syringes. I mean, this includes clean swabs for their skin, a sterilized device called a cooker. Some people on the streets use bottle caps or spoons to do heroin. And after they have this clean equipment, they use. This way, they won't contract infectious diseases knowing that their equipment is clean. Nurses are then standing by with oxygen and naloxone in case they have an overdose. It can be reversed. And then they're done. They go into an area called a chill room where their breathing and other vital signs are being monitored by officials. And then social workers will then talk to them about detox, about longer-term drug treatment programs, about trying to turn their life around if that's what they want. The people who work there, they're very non-judgmental, and they don't want to force anyone to do anything, but those social services and being a bridge for those social services is what the advocates say safe injection sites can really do it and why they're so powerful.
You're describing a medically safe zone, though, that they're entering with their own illicit drugs. Are they also safe from prosecution?
So it should be noted that no U.S. city has successfully launched a safe injection site. There's about 100 facilities around the world. There's one in Vancouver, and some other parts of Canada are looking to expand. There has been proposals in Seattle, San Francisco, New York. Philadelphia might become the first city to actually open one. The police have not yet said they're fully on board with this proposal. Federal law enforcement have said in other jurisdictions, if a safe injection site is launched, we, the federal government, will muster all of the resources of federal law enforcement, seize your assets, and prosecute everyone from the top down.
What's the impetus in the city for Philadelphia to become the first in the nation in this regard?
There's a few factors going on here. One is the depth of the opioid crisis in Philadelphia. I mean, 1,200 people are expected, once the final tally is counted, to have died last year from opioid-related deaths. So there's the crisis. Two, we have a new Maverick District Attorney, Larry Krasner, who came in campaigning to basically reverse the world order that everyone knew about criminal justice in the city. And he says he's not going to prosecute anyone using drugs at a safe injection site. Three, we have Mayor Jim Kenney, who has made this a priority, has hired a harm reductionist, has started a task force to try to tackle some of the issues related to the opioid crisis. And the crisis is very concentrated in Philadelphia, in Kensington. In some other cities, it's pretty diffuse. It's very concentrated in the neighborhood of Kensington. And all of these factors combined make experts say Philadelphia is uniquely positioned to be the first city to try this.
Though I'm sure part of the counterargument is that these supervised injection sites become magnets for crime and increased drug use. Are we seeing that overseas in cities that already have some form of this plan?
There's a place called Insight in Vancouver that opened in 2003 where a lot of studies have been based. That's a safe injection site in Canada. And they found that the number of fatal overdoses in the years after it opened right around the safe injection site dropped 35%. Now, that's not 80%. That's not 90%.
It's still pretty dramatic.
It's still pretty dramatic, more than a third. So it unequivocally does drive down the number of fatal overdoses. Studies have also found that it doesn't increase drug trafficking, that it is not a magnet for other types of violent crime. Now, those studies are often pointed to by advocates. You talk to neighbors and they say, yeah, those studies are biased. We don't believe it. We still don't like it. Neighbors in Kensington are split on this. Some are welcoming it with open arms and want to address the crisis head on. Others just don't want this on their block, and they think it is encouraging and even normalizing the use of illegal drugs.
I understand you reached out to the director of Temple University's Center for Public Health Law Research.
Yeah, Scott Burris leads the Temple University Center for Public Health Law. And I basically asked him, you know, do these supervised injection sites lead to more drug use, as some of the critics say? And here's what he told me.
Supervised injection doesn't create more heroin use or crime any more than smoking cessation creates more smoking. Services don't create the problem that they're meant to help.
And so the advent of 2018, where does the proposal stand at this juncture?
Right now, our new DA, Larry Krasner, says he is for it. Kenny is studying it and leaning towards being a full-throated supporter, but has yet to say that publicly. Others high up in City Hall who work in health and behavioral health services are definitely on board. The Philadelphia Police Department is kind of the wild card. Commissioner Richard Ross is pretty leery about it, and the federal government is also not very thrilled about this and has threatened prosecution. So is Philly actually going to do this? I truly don't know, Dave. Some signs are pointing to yes, some signs are pointing to no, but they're having a really robust debate about it now, and we might be farther along than almost any other city in America.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY's Bobby Allen on Newsworks Tonight. It's really cold outside, and it's going to be even colder this weekend. For Philadelphia's homeless shelters, that means welcoming a constant stream of people in search of warmth. WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports.
Nehemiah Howard walked into Sunday Breakfast Rescue Mission a week ago to get out of the cold. He's rarely left the Center City shelter since.
I mean, you see me, I'm dressed and bundled up. And I haven't been outside, not today at all. And I don't look like I ain't planning to go out.
Howard says staying inside so much has been hard. At times, he's felt a bit claustrophobic, especially when the cold interferes with his plans. Like today, he was supposed to head to West Philly for his cousin's birthday.
I feel disappointed. You know, when it's somebody's birthday, you want to try to celebrate with them, or at least, you know, say hi, you know, show up.
This year, a happy birthday text message will have to do. Harvey Bast has worked at Sunday Breakfast for two decades. This is one of the busiest stretches he's seen. All 240 of the shelter's beds are taken.
And then we have people sitting in chairs at night because there's no more beds, but we don't turn anyone away.
Bast says many, like Nehemiah Howard, aren't going far during the day.
They're not moving. They're still here. If you were looking into the room next door, you would see it's full.
During a code blue alert, hundreds of shelter beds are added to the city's stock to accommodate more homeless people who want to come inside. On any given night, around 80% of those nearly 3,000 beds have been filled. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Public disdain for the federal government tops the list of important problems facing the country today, though Americans are much more positive when they can pick a la carte. Let's look at the menu with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, it's interesting. We don't like federal government writ large, but certain aspects of it seem to be quite popular.
What you're referring to is research where we've asked people to give us their opinions of specific agencies within the government, and here we find a lot of positivity. We have used the two words, by the way, just to set the stage, federal government, and we find much more negative than positive when we hear those two words out there across the country. But when we say U.S. Postal Service, 74%, an excellent or good rating. When we say the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 66% favorable rating. The Secret Service, 63% favorable rating. Homeland Security, well into the majority territory, and the FBI and the CIA the same way, and NASA also gets good ratings.
Glass half full, but now take us to the bottom.
Well, unfortunately, it is the VA still. The VA has had a bad reputation historically. Donald Trump, of course, said in his campaign that he would do something about that. But Americans don't have a very positive opinion on a relative basis of the VA. And then also down there near the bottom is the Internal Revenue Service. And then the EPA is also down near the bottom.
Frank, the EPA is interesting. Is it for doing too much or not enough?
Well, we don't know exactly why the EPA gets the ratings that it does. And in fact, it's one of those where we might expect that Republicans would be less positive than Democrats, but that's not the case. They're roughly equal when we look at how these two groups rate the EPA. A big difference, however, comes when we look at FEMA, where Democrats are much less positive than Republicans, and Homeland Security much less positive. And then I should point out, still speaking about these partisan differences, that we get a big, big difference in terms of evaluations of the FBI. Now, I mentioned earlier the FBI overall gets a pretty good rating, but there's a 20-point difference between the rating of the FBI between Democrats and Republicans, with Republicans at the lower end of that. And, of course, that follows from President Trump and others' criticism of the FBI in recent months.
Now, when you say positivity, I think White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee and her assessment of Donald Trump's first year in office. Are her opinions mirrored in the public mind?
Well, she said, to be very specific, that the Trump presidency was probably one of the most successful first years in office. So we would ask what the criteria are for that. And, of course, my job is to look at it from the eyes of the American public. And here we don't see it. You know, Trump's rating for the calendar year 2017 was 39%, the lowest for any newly elected president in our history. Overall satisfaction with the way things are going in the country came in at 27% for 2017, and that's not a robust number. Although I should say that's no worse than some of other presidents' first years in office, which came in pretty bad times, like Clinton and Reagan. They also had pretty low overall satisfaction numbers. And then Congress approval, as we've talked about many times, is also low. So we don't find any empirical indicators from the public's perspective that would say this has been a wildly successful first year for the Trump administration. But we'll see what happens going forward.
Though it seems pretty much beyond dispute that the economy is red hot, wouldn't that help to bolster the president's image?
One would think that it would. Typically, when the economy is strong, for example, in the dot-com boom, we had very high ratings up in the high 60% range for Bill Clinton, and one rating was 70%, even though he was being impeached at the time. So typically the two go together. In the mid-80s, when Reagan got pretty good ratings, the economy was also doing well. So we have more of a disjuncture now than we have at any time in the past. Part of that may be partisanship, Dave. The simple facts are that Democrats just cannot come to tell us pollsters that the economy is doing very well. And again, this is taking into account that the stock market was doing well last year, unemployment was down. But when you ask Democrats across the country, how's the economy doing, they're very negative on a relative basis to where they were in the previous years. And of course, Republicans shot up.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Last year was a whirlwind for Washington lawmakers, but gridlock reigned supreme and much of the GOP agenda was blocked. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo caught up with legislators from our region about what they're hoping to accomplish in 2018.
President Donald Trump told voters he would come to Washington and shake things up, which he surely has, but not in the way many people expected. He spent much of last year frustrated that he couldn't get much of his agenda through Congress.
It's been a tumultuous year.
That's South Jersey Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur. He played a pivotal role in crafting a deal that revived the GOP effort to repeal Obamacare. And while that was able to pass the House, it died in the Senate. After that, MacArthur also played an outspoken role in negotiations on the tax overhaul, which was able to pass on a strictly party-line vote. MacArthur says this year he's hoping his party will reach across the aisle more.
I think overall, for me personally, one of the lessons out of this year is that when you do things in a partisan way only, you basically invite the other side, which has no stake in the outcome, to just blast everything you do. And I don't think it's ideal, personally. I think that we should try to engage more with the Democrats.
Other Republicans from our region echo that sentiment. New Jersey Congressman Leonard Lance opposed his party's effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act out of concerns that fewer people would be covered and that premiums would not get less expensive. He says improving the ACA remains a good spot for both parties to come together early in this new year.
I think we have to work in a bipartisan capacity on reform of Obamacare. I certainly think it needs reform, but the best way to do that is from the center out, working in a bipartisan capacity.
President Trump has frustrated lawmakers in both parties by using Twitter to aggressively go after his critics, even if they're Republicans. But Lance says Democrats also share some of the blame for the bad blood that marks today's politics, like when Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer canceled a meeting with the president on a year-end spending package. They called it off in response to tweets from the president saying he didn't think a deal was in sight, which Lance says was short-sighted.
I would hope, moving forward, that we can work together in a bipartisan capacity. That includes not only the president, but includes leadership here on Capitol Hill. And in particular, I think it's important for the Democratic leadership to be willing to meet with the president and not to forego those opportunities.
But Democrats say the GOP has moved so far to the right that it's hard to negotiate with them. Pennsylvania Democratic Senator Bob Casey says that's why Democrats were able to win an Alabama Senate seat for the first time in 25 years. He says the politics from races like that are having an impact on policymaking in Washington.
I think they've allowed their extremes to kind of drive the bus every day. And that's one of the reasons they had trouble in Alabama. I mean, you saw the extremes getting not just support, but being nominated. But I think it's also hurt on policy.
Despite this, Casey and other Democrats say they're willing to negotiate and pass bills in 2018 with the GOP majority, but only if Republican leaders give them a seat at the table.
Oh, sure. I think certainly on infrastructure, which is what we should have started 2017 with. I think even the president would admit that. But I hope that's still an area of focus for Republicans.
Then there's foreign policy. Last year, lawmakers overwhelmingly approved new sanctions against Russia to punish the country for interfering with the 2016 election. But the White House has yet to enforce those. Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons says he needs help from Republicans in forcing Trump to step up pressure on Russia this year.
I don't believe they have followed up and enforced the law. I think Congress, on a very strong bipartisan basis, gave them a significant new set of tools and a clear signal that we want action taken to make Russia pay a price for their meddling in our 2016 election.
While most of what you hear in the news is about gridlock or the intense partisanship that marks Washington, Bucks County Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick says it's not as bad as it seems in some parts of the Capitol.
If you look at members of our freshman class, we're friends. We're not just colleagues, we're friends, and we respect each other as human beings, and we want to co-sponsor bills together. We want to see each other succeed in each other's districts, and that's a good thing. And I think that's what Congress needs more of.
2018 is an election year. That often means more gridlock than usual. Optimists in Washington hope it will drive both sides to the middle so they have something to brag about on the campaign trail. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Mussoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the helm this week, Charlie Kyer and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.